Mackenzie.
Lamar.
We are coming in hot today in Action April with Gene Hackman playing a cop on the edge with nothing to lose, one of the earlier versions of this, but kind of pioneering this new take on that. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to obviously lead with rest in power to Mr. Hackman himself. And with that in mind, I wanted to know, you know, I Googled what his top performances were. He's obviously won a couple Oscars and whatnot, including this one. But for you, personal favorite Gene Hackman films, what are the ones that you really like to dig into, rewatch, all that good stuff?
Well, as usual, this is hard for me, but
I'll allow you to pick more than one, you know, this time.
I get a pass this time. Amazing.
This one time, yeah.
Because I never do that ever other times. but yeah, so no, it is hard for me, I will say, but I think that some of my picks are probably not always the most straightforward, obvious picks either, because I think people think of things like, of course, this, The French Connection, mm-hmm. and then also Unforgiven, mm-hmm. which I think is a great one and would like definitely be one that I rewatch that I really like. And so that's probably on my list. But I think people think of that one first, or this one first, or even Royal Tenenbaums. Like, people yeah. loved him in that. Yeah.
People love that.
But I like him a lot in Enemy of the State. I think Same. He's really good in that. He's really fun. It's some pieces of this come through, right? Like, some of the same character come through a little bit, but on the whole, I feel like it's a little bit of a different character for him. He's like this paranoid guy.
That's what anyway, I was going to say. So, he plays a really good kind of government paranoia yeah, conspiracy yeah. theorist in that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you could be like, he plays it well enough to where you're like, is he a little crazy? Like, does right. he, is it not real, or is he actually right? Which, of course, we end up finding out. So I like his performance in that. And then this is such a random one, but I really love Runaway Jury. I think I've said that before on the pod. Okay. He plays Rankin Fitch in that. And you see, like, one of the things that he yells in this movie is copied and pasted into Runaway Jury. Like, it's exact okay. same delivery. So it just feels like classic Gene Hackman, but it's a very different courthouse thriller. And it's not the most quality movie in the world, but it's got great people in it. It's Rachel Weisz, Dustin Hoffman, him, John Cusack. And it's just like a fun time. I don't know. I think it's a fun time, and he's really good in it. So those are probably not, I don't know, probably atypical picks, I guess.
Well, we'll have to check out Runaway Jury at some point, because I've never seen that one either. So
it's really good. I mean, he didn't do bad stuff. He was really funny in Heartbreakers. I know we talked about that one.
Yeah,
one
I was time like, I pod, mentioned like, that on the pod before, in the story yeah. of how I had a roommate in college, and him and his boyfriend would watch that movie four nights a week. So I yeah. learned to love Heartbreakers, and I knew yeah. like a lot of the dialogue in it. I also have a soft spot for The Replacements, which we covered. I know it's goofy.
Oh, yes. But you get I just watched Reeves. That the other day. So good.
It's a fun, stupid movie. It's definitely a product of its time, but that one's very fun. And then I just finally saw The Birdcage for the first time. I know he has a slightly smaller role in that, but I think he plays it to a T. So,
yeah, I totally agree. It's so funny. I was just watching The Replacements because I've been traveling a lot for work. So mm-hmm. I'm in hotels, and you just watch what's on TV sometimes. And The Replacements was on the other night, and it was the scene where Shane Falco is kissing the bartender for the first time. and they're like narrating commentary. It. Yeah. I just love that scene so much. It's so good. Yeah, anyway, yeah. I digress. But yes, rest in power, Mr. Gene Hackman. We're excited to talk about this one. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
And we are starting a whole new month here on the pod, about which I'm very excited. It is called Action! Exclamation point. Don't miss the exclamation point. April. So
yeah, stoked. Because we haven't done a ton of action on the pod, yeah. right?
Not really. And it's funny because I don't really attribute my taste in movies to any one genre. Mm-hmm. I think I like most everything. But fuck, I really like action. Is what I have learned, that I really enjoy a good action movie. Yeah. So I'm excited about this one. We're going to kick it off with, like we said, we're going to do some homage to Mr. Gene Hackman this week. We're going to start with one of his best, The French Connection.
Yeah. And it's worth noting, I think we ended up picking a movie from each decade for the most part. Yep. We might skip one in there, but so we'll kind of be going I don't know if we're doing them officially in release order, but we'll get some variety in there.
We are, because I'm OCD. I don't know what to tell y'all. That's what we're going to do. But yeah, no, we did. I think we did actually get one from each decade. So yeah, we're starting in the 70s, that is. But we're going to go from there. I think it's going to be a good time. All right. So to get us through this first one, what are we drinking?
All right. So this one is pretty straightforward, but thank you at Craft World as always. And this is a riff on a sidecar. Get it? Because they find drugs in sidecar. Eventually, spoiler for this film, if you've never seen it, there are drugs involved and a vehicle. But this is a riff on that. So I had to Google what the difference is between cognac and brandy, because I thought they were two very different. It's kind of like a square rectangle situation. Mm-hmm, like brandy is a type of cognac or whatever, something specific like that. You guys Google it if you give a shit. But this is a riff because we used apple brandy instead of cognac. And it's, like I said, pretty straightforward. It's 2 ounces of that, then 0.75 ounces each of lemon juice and simple syrup. And we are calling this one, because it is a riff on a sidecar, The Chase, which I think fits this very well. I do want to point out, if my brother Chase is listening, we are not naming this drink after you. This is in no way in your honor. This is all about the plot of the film.
I like you, you know, heading that off at the pass. You're like, absolutely not.
Just need him to know he's not that special, but I love you, brother. Okay.
All right. Cheers.
Cheers.
Yeah, sorry. We couldn't make a for real sidecar this time, but we tried.
That is really fucking tasty. The apple brandy actually goes really well with that.
I just want you to know behind the scenes that he tried to make you drink a Negroni and I stopped him. So
thank you. I appreciate that. Does that one have Aperol or does it have?
That's Campari.
Campari.
It's two. Even more bitter. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So I protected you on this one. I'm just saying.
Thank you. Thank you, friend.
Alrighty. So let's get into the good stuff. I don't think we're really going to do a spoiler warning this time. Do you have strong feelings? This is quite an old film.
I'm good with it. It's what, 53 years old at this point? Yeah.
Yeah. It's been a hot minute, guys. Go watch it. So turn around, don't drown. I guess it's spoiler time, where the whole thing is spoiler rich. The French Connection, 1971. Very well received. So 7.7 out of 10 on IMDb, 97% from critics on Rotten Tomatoes, like damn, and 87% from audiences. So, and I think we'll get into why I think that is, where it's a little bit lower, but still very well received here in a minute. But our director here is Mr. William Friedkin. Pop quiz. Who is that, Lamar? I guess you probably took notes.
I did take some notes. So William Friedkin has been directing shit for decades. Most people probably know him best for The Exorcist, which he got because of this movie, which is weird because you don't think of those as being similar at all. But I guess the producers just saw this and saw the intensity and the realism. And they wanted The Exorcist to not feel like a silly horror movie. They wanted this sense of realism. And I mean, we've mentioned that before during our Halloweenish, our famous, infamous Halloweenish episode.
Infamous Halloweenish
episode. How that movie feels. The first half of it is a medical drama and you're just feeling bad for this girl. And I think that you can see those realism components between these two.
Yeah. And I think it's important to note that documentary-esque style is, I think, really what got him the job. But what inspired that in this film was another film, Z, which I actually haven't seen, but it was like eye-opening for him. He said that he didn't realize you could even make a film that way. He was like, I watched this film and I realized that's how I could shoot The French Connection. He shot it like a documentary. It was a fictional film, but you felt like you were in it while it was actually happening. And it was a very different style of shooting for fictional films. And I think that's part of what comes through in The Exorcist, definitely comes through here. You feel like you're watching like a cop doc, basically.
Yeah, we will get to some of the shots in this that I think are really, really cool. He did more. I thought it was interesting that he's a Best Picture director, but he's done horror. And obviously The Exorcist is kind of a standout from that. But he also did Bug in the aughts with Ashley Judd. And I think it was Michael Shannon. And that was like body horror. And I found it interesting that he does so many little horror things. And he actually, you'll love this, cited The Babadook as the scariest movie he's ever seen.
Yeah. He knows what's up. I mean, it's so good. But he also does other, you know, some really different stuff. I do want to call out his range here. He did The Boys in the Band, which is a hallmark of queer film. It's considered one of the first really strong queer films ever made. And then they did a remake of it recently, but he did the first one.
Going a different direction. I thought you were going to say it's a hallmark film. I was like, oh, good for him. But you went
literally not. Oh my God. he would have, you know, he, that would have been the beginning of the end for him, I feel like, you know. He also did, and I think I've mentioned this on the pod before, he did a follow-up actual documentary to The Exorcist that was intended to follow the priest that was the inspiration for The Exorcist, Father Amaranth. And it is kind of the worst thing I've ever seen.
It's kind of the worst. Worse than Street Fighter, really.
Well, okay, no, not worse than Street Fighter. That's impossible.
That's always going to be my go-to question anytime you say, oh, this was so bad. Well, was it worse than Street Fighter?
No, it was not. But it was just so, it was one of those, like, it kind of gets you on the hook to try and find this true exorcism moment, right? You're trying to see it in real life. And then the stuff that it shows is just so gimmicky. And it's like,
got it.
It's just somebody making weird noises. And I was really kind of disappointed. I was like, why did you still release this? I mean, if you went and you did the research and you're trying to just do a real life documentary and then this is what you encounter, like, fine, but don't put it out. Like, it just wasn't that good. So anyway, but if-
I had never heard of that. So I might seek it out just out of morbid curiosity at this
point. I think it's free on Amazon Prime or something. So
like,
yeah.
Spinning off of that though, this is based on like a semi-true story, right?
Semi-true
a book
story.
And real cops. And that's how they did it. Like, I didn't do a ton of deep dives into that, but I just wanted to confirm this is true-ish.
Yes. This is based on real people, like down to the criminal, down okay. to like everybody is based on, a couple of them are amalgamations of characters, but on the whole, the two cops are based on real people and the main bad guy is based on a real guy. It is important to note, and we'll get to it at the end, that of course it's a little bit different than what they say. I mean, it's just going to happen, right, in Hollywood. But there were strong feelings about how it was different. But it is captured in a lot of critiques on the film where they're like, it's basically the skeleton of the true story. And then he just changed it. He almost just wanted to have this very formulaic version of just a typical action cop flick. Like Bullet had been very successful. A couple things like that had been very successful. Bullet prior to this had the most famous car chase. He wanted to emulate that. He was trying to follow a formula and he was very clear about that. But he does it so well that there's still so much respect for the film, I think. So
yeah, there's a sense of sincerity and just a genuine experience of police officers. I said there are two pieces of subject matter that definitely borrowed heavily from this, or at least learned from it and emulated it a little bit. And the first one's The Wire, because I think both of these, this and The Wire, just have this sense they're doing a stakeout and it's boring as hell. They're just sitting in the car and they do that. They show you in The Wire just how mundane, when you have wiretaps, how what that looks like, and sort of these cops who are, they're not cartoonish like you see in a lot of action films where it's, you know, good cop, bad cop kind of thing. They feel real, but it's cops that are realistically stressed and they have difficult lives, and you see some of that play out here too. So I think The Wire borrowed heavily from this in a good way, because I love both. But the second thing that borrowed very heavily that I got vibes from was Bad Boys. Because it's like the whole two cops, the chief is like,
pretty
you're off the case, you're going too, blah, you're too invested. Da, 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 da. So they could have called this Bad White Boys if they wanted to. That could have been the alternate title for this film. I know it came out 30 years prior, but we could rename it that if we wanted to, I'm saying.
We could. They should have Woosah Jimmy is all I'm saying, for sure. But yeah, I think also the source material we should talk about quick second. Robin Moore wrote the book that this is based on, like, to your point, is a true story. The book is called The French Connection, but it is a true account of cops, narcotics, and international conspiracy is the subtitle. So, and the actual screenplay was done by Ernest Tittyman, and then William Friedkin did some like uncredited writing and edits on it.
Just to confirm, his name is Ernest Tittyman. Tittyman made me laugh. Okay. I was like, is it Tidy Man? Titty Man?
It
I kind of want to say
Man,
Titty
Man. I don't know. I feel like I heard somebody say Titty Man. Who knows? Well,
he knows what he likes. And he did all the Shaft movies, right? Or he wrote the book that Shaft was based on.
Yeah,
something like
I think
that.
He wrote the book. Yeah.
I saw he's one of the few folks, a white person, to win an NAACP award, which I was like, that's interesting to think about. I wouldn't think the writer of Shaft was a white guy, but there you go.
That's true. I mean, and that's an accomplishment. You know, they're inviting you to the cookout, so that's good.
I hope to get there someday. Maybe, you know, that's on my
bucket
list.
Oh, you've never been?
NAACP award. Well, the cookout and the NAACP award. If I can do both in the same year, that'd be great.
The cookout's better, I'm just saying.
Okay,
like,
fair.
That's the one to go for sure, for
like
sure.
The NAACP awards are a dull affair.
I mean, don't get me wrong, that's cool and all, but it's not a cookout, so... Sure. All right, let's get into some cast and crew and then have some fun. So Mr. Gene Hackman, as we said, plays Jimmy Doyle, the like angry cop, so the bad cop in this situation. We talked about several of his movies, so we can go right through that. But Roy Scheider plays his partner in crime, Buddy Russo.
I would go Russo.
I would go Russo. Yeah. All right. And we have talked about him before on the pod, obviously, in Jaws. Mm-hmm. But also, I think it's important to call out his range, you know, all that jazz.
Yeah, he did Jaws 2 as well. So
he did. Really shaking it up.
Like, he was supposed to be in The Deer Hunter. I don't know if it was the De Niro role, but he turned that down. The studio was pissed and made him do Jaws 2 as penance.
It was a punishment. They're like, yeah. Hey, you owe us. You owe us for this.
For this one, he didn't think he was going to get the part. I guess he angrily stormed out of the audition when he heard there were no sharks involved in the program. But
sure,
he stormed out. But that's why they gave him the part, was they needed that hard nose, that edge. And so they went, yeah, that's the guy. He's very emotional. Put him in a cop movie.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, you know, sometimes it's there's several stories like that. My actors, if they like throw a tantrum, mm-hmm. or they get mad or they do something, and that's the thing that gets them the job. So I love that for him. We also have Mr. Fernando Rey plays Alan Charnier, French. I haven't seen anything that he's done. Things that, you know, he's known for are Tristana, The Obscure Object of Desire. Have you seen any of his stuff?
No, I think he did mostly films in Spain and France, if I remember correctly, but I didn't recognize any of them.
Yeah, you know, that's where I would say that's where I'm lacking is Italian film, especially, mm-hmm. but I'm better with my French films, but not as good. So yeah, haven't seen much of his stuff, which will continue on theme here. Tony LoBianco plays Sal Boca. And he was in something called Nixon that I haven't seen. It was like not that old, but I haven't seen it. And Kill the Irishman, also haven't seen it. See either of those for you?
Was that one a documentary about the making of The Irishman, similar to the other one about The Exorcist?
I don't think anybody should have made a documentary about the making of The Irishman. It was long enough. It's eight hours long. Yeah, we're good. Okay. And then finally, Marcel Bazoufi? Mm-hmm. Pierre Niccoli, he is also in Z, one of the things, like we said, that inspired the making how this film is made. And then he's not in a lot of other stuff that people would probably know, but did some like TV movies kinds of things. So we got an interesting mix of people that probably a lot of y'all won't recognize. Quick plot summary. A pair of NYPD detectives and the Narcotics Bureau stumble onto a heroin smuggling ring based in Marseille. But stopping them and capturing their leaders proves an elusive goal.
Dun, dun, dun. Yeah, it's very, very cat and mouse throughout, and we've already addressed sort of the chase that we'll get to, but those ending 30 minutes of this pursuit, the chase, the sting, it's all set up by this continuous pursuit. It doesn't take long for them to start investigating, and this just feels like and it was a relatively short movie, which I always appreciate, but yeah, it was what, like an hour and 40, and it's just front to back this cat and mouse game, which I really liked watching.
And I will say, like, I think it does start a little slow, but then you start to get the feel for it and you get into that cat and mouse, like you said. A couple quick notes about the film, if you didn't know, it was nominated for 8 Oscars and it won 5 of them. So pretty solid run, including Best Picture and actually Best Actor for Gene Hackman, Best Director, Best Film Editing, and Best Adapted Screenplay. So I think all those really check out. I didn't really compare what it was up against at the time, but especially from a performance lens, thought it was a great performance and a really well done film. Yeah. And
I didn't say this earlier. This was my first time watching this. And I think we've had this experience before, especially when we did the classics month, of when you haven't seen something from so long ago, it's hard to put out of your mind all the things that have copied it afterwards or borrowed themes from it. So I tried to clear myself on this one and be like, let me just watch this with fresh eyes as if I've never seen a cop action movie before.
Yeah.
And that did help, but you do see how much this really set the bar for stuff that came after.
Yeah, I mean, it established a lot of these tropes. I mean, really, I think this is one of the films, including some others, that really established the dynamic of good cop, bad cop. And like you said, this cat and mouse and this chase dynamic of like, we're on the hunt for these people. And it's an interesting topic, too, of narcotics at this time and making it this like global international thing. So I think it contributes to even other stuff like Bond and things like that. So there's a lot of themes that are common here, I think.
I was going to say that, one of the things I wrote down and it set me off pretty, it triggered me a little bit, because you remember how much I didn't love Humphrey Bogart in Maltese Falcon, and I said this kind of character archetype of the no-nonsense cop who's going to give you a sock in the mouth if you don't listen to me, and then it's trying to smooch every lady in the movie. This movie didn't have that. I think there was a total of one female character, two female characters in the whole thing, so I was grateful that it didn't have that, yeah. But I did, at first, I went, oh man, this is that archetype of Gene Hackman, of just like, I'm a tough cop, and blah. He even says at some point, if you keep talking like that, I'm going to knock you right into next week. And I went, oh, this is so Bogart. Triggered me a little bit, and then as it went on, I embraced sort of how this is supposed to be a real guy and found out it was based on a real person. It made more sense.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there are only like two women in the whole thing, and one of them is running away naked in his apartment. So he kind of, you know, fleshes out that like bachelor cop trope to start. So it is easy to be like, is this going to be like a very one-dimensional performance? But I don't think it is. But I do think it is a precursor for him later, Gene Hackman later. Like he employs a lot of these tactics later. And so it is interesting to see kind of his first performance like this, where you're like, this becomes his style. It becomes what he's kind of cast for, almost. Not 100% of the time, like we said, but some of the time for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, the Academy agrees with you. So
yeah, they do. They do. The audience also agrees with us. So $2 million budget, and $75 million at the time, again, in the 70s, that's a pretty solid return on a pretty cheap budget. And we'll get into more of the production notes as we go through of like, this was real cheap, and we did some shady shit to get this film made. So it kind of makes sense. But yeah, let's get into it.
Can we talk about how fucking hard the opening credits go right off the bat? I pushed play on Amazon, I think it was, on Prime, and the 20th Century Fox, I'm so used to the drums and whatnot, but it's silent, I guess, on this. So I thought I had it muted. And then suddenly out of nowhere, the music just blasts. The titles are on screen. And there's so many big bombastic music cues throughout this. Some of them feel a little silly to me. Like it zooms in on somebody. It's like, bang. But those opening credits go hard.
Yeah, they do go hard. It's very William Friedkin, by the way. Like, he does shit like that. He does that in The Exorcist, too. Like, there's just a lot of intense sound effects and these, like, loud, in-your-face moments. And, yeah, we don't get off easy when we start this one. And it certainly flows right into the beginning where we're getting to know our characters. And out of the gate, Gene Hackman, again, is just the hothead cop right away. Yeah. We're seeing it immediately. And he's in – my favorite thing is that he's in the Santa suit. We get Santa.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
In the stakeout. And what's funny, one of my favorite things about that is that was, again, this is based on a true story. That was one of their tactics, because they were like, you know, when we were staking out these narcotic guys, anybody in like plain clothes was obvious to them. They were, they had eyes on plain clothes people all the time. There was also apparently a big, the New York cops would put like a hat in the back seat of their car to show they were doing a stakeout undercover, whatever. So there were lots of cues that like criminals could pick up on. But the one thing that they felt they wouldn't even notice is the Salvation Army Santa Claus. And apparently it worked.
I feel for the children in that scenario where Santa, you just gave money to Santa and told him what you want for Christmas. And then he starts beating the shit out of a bunch of people. What is Santa doing? And I'll also say
raging and cursing and for everyone to see.
Right. All those poor kids. And I will point out, it was a little uncomfortable for me in the two scenes in this where they're going into bars predominantly with all black patrons and seeing them rough everybody up. And I get it. It's going for realism. And that probably in 1971 and today is probably still something that happens, but it was still very uncomfortable to watch. I did like that they eventually had an informant who they were working with, and they do like that whole thing in the bathroom. So it was good to see. This movie doesn't pass the Bechdel test, but at least there's characters that are not, it's not just the white knights throughout this whole film. So that was good.
Yeah. And I do think it shows you that they as cops are maybe not actually really being quite this racist and discriminatory. They have a reason to be in there and they're playing a role. They're playing this bad cop so they can get to this guy. So it makes a lot more sense as you watch it. Fun fact about that scene, those were all real cops. So they were all like fun, real cop extras. So that was pretty cool.
Good with it, I'm good with it. So yeah.
Right. They're getting beat up. They're fine with it. It's totally fine.
And they've all got like, you know, in the cop's defense, they have scenes where literally everyone in the bar has drugs on them. So they are guilty. I'm just saying the casting folks could have been like, hey, let's throw a couple white guys at the bar, or like, you know, it just felt a little weird.
We could have done that. We could have done that for sure. For sure. I also just like, I just want to take a broad note on, I like how much of like old gritty New York we get to see, and that it is filmed in such a way that really reflects that grittiness and that era. And, you know, this is not quite the pre, like what people consider a really dangerous time in New York, but it's kind of leading up to that. And you're seeing where it's both simultaneously being built up and starting to grow even more into this big city. You see the beginning of the Twin Towers. They're like half complete. They're not totally complete there. And you just get this really interesting picture of all these different pockets of New York and the people and the look and the grittiness, but in a like almost nostalgic way. I know it wasn't nostalgic at the time, but now it feels a little bit nostalgic to watch. It's kind of cool.
That was my second note that I wrote down was, wow, it's really cool seeing Brooklyn in 1971 and looking at the shops and all that stuff and the different bars that they're going into. I also felt like when we did Do the Right Thing, we saw that section of Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn as well. And obviously that was what, 90s or late 80s. But it's I love it when they do film in New York City and you see its evolution over the decades. I also felt this movie captured how fucking cold it gets in New York City, because it's snow. But seeing them bundle up and seeing him during the stakeout and he's getting cold and he's like rubbing his feet and like doing whatever he can to stay warm. I've been there, man. It sucks walking around New York City in the winter.
It super does. And he's like, I mean, he wanted it to look even colder. Like the director wanted it to look colder. He actually made the, he changed the color timing so that it would look colder on film, apparently. And so like him and the cinematographer worked with that. But of course it is genuinely very cold in New York at that time, but he just really did want you to feel that and see that come through for sure. So I thought that was really cool. And again, I do want to touch on it, just the way it is shot is so interesting. And the, I think the description that I liked the most when he was being interviewed about it was that it's like the camera doesn't know what's going to happen next. And overall, he did really, of course, plan some of these shots just like any other film, but sometimes that was literally true, right? Like sometimes they were guerrilla filming this thing, you know? Yeah. So they're adjusting as they're filming, depending on the scene. And it becomes really relevant later in one of the biggest scenes in the film, but you see that throughout.
It's it feels shaky. Cam. I feel like I was watching Friday Night Lights, the TV series again, where everything's like handheld and it's a little wavy. Like, and I think they did shots in this where he didn't want to use a dolly, so they just threw people in wheelchairs and had them roll like that way with using the camera. So it definitely feels just very tense because of the way that it's shot.
Yeah. And it, I mean, and I think you are supposed to feel immersed in these cops day to day and their job, and like you are literally running with Gene Hackman right away. And so I actually like that. My first thought was, he's really getting a workout in this, and that continues throughout.
Seeing Gene Hackman sprint was new to me. I've never seen Gene Hackman run in a movie because I hadn't seen much before, you know, he was older, how we all people my age remember him. So I was like, holy shit, Gene Hackman's in great shape.
Yeah. Also, by the way, he's 41 when this gets released and he is hauling ass. But I also think it's funny that he's supposed to be kind of like, again, the bachelor player cop a little bit. And he already, all due respect to those no longer with us, looks kind of old. Like he already looks old. It's so funny how much older we looked back then. I think that's true of all kinds of other films. When you're like in your 40s, you kind of already are aging a bit quicker. And he looks every bit of 41, if you know, in this film, and he's supposed to be like the young cop who's running and racing through
I feel like that's a Hollywood thing, though, or maybe New York too in this case. But it's just, we always seem to be okay with having older men be these like handsome, and like I think we've gotten better about it, but it's always creepy to watch movies even from the 90s or 80s where it's like somebody in their 40s and they're dating a girl in their 20s in the movie. And it's just male writers, male directors that go, yeah, this makes sense.
Yeah, no, it doesn't make sense, by the way. Listen, unless that person, because there's always going to be this factor, unless that person has crazy money, like, no thing, that's
Leonardo
not
DiCaprio.
Thing.
I thought you were just right. Going to go straight there. Yeah.
100%. Leonardo DiCaprio is going to always get young women because it's Leonardo DiCaprio, right? But
maybe not an NYPD detective, though.
Maybe not an NYPD detective is taking home that, like, very young, gorgeous woman at 41. But whatever. I digress. Anyways, so this, I just want to give like a very broad beginning to this too, because we don't get a ton of action related to this specific case at first, right? We get this like other thing to introduce us to the cops. We get a feel for what their day to day is like. And then we find out they're trying to dig into this more intense, more long-term bust of this French connection, this French heroin importer, and track down like, when is the heroin coming in? How are they getting the drugs here? How is this ending up on the street to the degree that it is? And you get a lot of back and forth with him and them and their narcotics team of like, you haven't had a good bust in a long time, right? Like there's pressure on them to get that next bust. And I think even though it starts slow and that as a viewer, you sort of feel that, I think that's kind of intentional, right? Of like, their busts are kind of slow. Like their cases are moving a little bit slow to start. They're trying to get their arms around their next big case, which ends up being this quote French connection.
And that's, you're touching on everything that makes this feel real, because in real life, cops' lives are not all that interesting. I mean, obviously we have instances on the news of fucked up things that happen, but when you look, I don't want to keep making this about The Wire, but in that, it's all about the investigation, and there's not shootouts between the cops and the criminals in real life very often. I think, fun fact about The Wire, the only cop that ever fires their gun, I think, on the whole show is the one goofball who does it by accident and just shoots a wall. So like, cops' lives are not all that interesting. A lot of it is this investigation piece, dead ends, you know, having the villains be smarter than the cops in many cases, which happens in this as well, and just stakeouts and like the occasional win, right? So I think that all lends itself to the realism we talked about.
Yeah. And I think it feels almost too like they stumble on this next case, right? Like it doesn't feel like, oh, this has been a long play and we've uncovered this super, you know, whatever. They're at the Copacabana having a drink and Popeye is just like observing Sal and is like, hey, some shit's going down. Basically, yeah, he's got a gut feeling here. And fun fact, the cop that this is based off of, the names are slightly different, but the nickname is the same. He was nicknamed Popeye. So he like observes this, he's watching these mobsters and he's like, there is some shit here. You know, it's a very like where there's smoke, there's fire kind of gut check with this guy of like, these are mobsters. They're here having these meetings, like some shit is going down. There's got to be some kind of connection here. And it turns out that there is, luckily, but they're kind of fishing to start.
I did like that. The Popeye, his intuition throughout, but they still show you how difficult it, like when you just will not let a gut feeling go. And it's at that piece where they first kick it off. It's when he knows there are drugs in the car, and I love that 10-minute sequence where they're showing you them take it apart, the entirety of the vehicle, and he still won't let it go. And eventually it does pay off. So I liked that about the character.
Yeah. I like that he, again, maybe he was fishing to start, but then he's like, no, there really is something here. And he kind of catches that scent. And you do see where he is a good detective. I also like the conflict between them as a partnership and their leaders, their captains, and specifically Moldering. Like Moldering fucking hates the these guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, and also
well,
can we talk about
his by the end. So fuck that guy.
He sure does. We'll get there. But Moldering, isn't it so funny that his name is Moldering? And then later in the X-Files, there's Mulder.
Mulder.
No. Anybody?
Yes.
Anybody?
Yes.
Okay. I was like, we're remember
both
that.
Nerds. I get
we're
it.
Both nerds. I was like, oh my God, Moldering.
Truth is out there.
It is. Okay. Anyways, I love that dynamic between them because again, it feels authentic. It feels gritty. It feels real. It feels like this person's going to be difficult for them. And I think what I like too is that they haven't put all the pieces together, but we get to simultaneously start to put some of the pieces together. Right. You know, we cut to Devereaux and we understand that that's the connection. That's how the drugs are getting in. He's like this famous actor guy, and he seemingly has nothing to do with this in that he doesn't really know what's going on. He knows that he's been asked for a favor And turns out it's coming in on his car, like you said. And then he wants to be removed from it as he feels the heat. But I want to talk about a couple of scenes because, again, it's pretty formulaic, right? Like, we figure out who these connections are. It's happening in parallel. They're putting the pieces together. They have a few stakeouts. They have a few chases that are important, right? But I think there's a couple of scenes that are really well done and interesting, including the subway scene where he is following him and Gene Hackman is like, I'm going to be super stealth, right? Like, I'm going to get this guy and I'm going to get on the train with him and I'm going to follow him. And you feel like, and
it's like taking the jacket off to look like a different person. So it's like, oh, yes. He doesn't pick up on the fact that he has a tail. And like, I like that you slowly realize the bad guy knows what's going on and he's trying to outsmart him as well.
Yeah. And they just, and it becomes a game. It just genuinely becomes a game. It's that cat and mouse game happening where they're just trying to fuck around. And, you know, and he, again, he thinks he's so chill. He's like, I'm going to get a candy apple and eat this. And I'm going to get a little drink and we're just going to chill here. And and I'm on the phone talking to the guy, like how I'm not going to take this bar shift, you know, like it just so many back and forth little things that you're like, y'all, everybody knows what's going on. Everybody
for
in the room
as good
knows what's
as
going
he
on.
Is at intuition, he's maybe not the best undercover tail guy in the business today. I love when he is intentionally stepping on and off the train to see if he's got the tail. And every time he steps off, you know, Popeye jumps out after him and then he goes back on. So he jumps back in. He has to find a reason for why he's doing it. I just love that he's testing the waters and eventually gets the best of him.
Yeah, I think it's funny. He like tosses the candy apple and there's a whole thing. And it just made me want a candy apple as well while I was watching that scene. I'm not going to lie. And it also made me question the cups, the little cone cups. I was like, we have cone cup holders instead of just making the cups flat. I mean, we eventually got there, but I thought it was funny that we have a little
holder. Shaved ice from when I was a kid.
But
I the wave as he's pulling out of the station again.
Oh, so just...
If you've seen The Wire, that just, sorry to keep bringing this up, but Avon Barksdale does that. He's being tailed and eventually like catches onto it. They're like, yeah, these are cops following us. And then eventually they drive by in their vehicle and he looks out the window at the cops and does like this kind of finger motion. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, that is ripped straight from this film. So again, really cool to see what gets borrowed.
It is nice to see the origins of it. I think that this inspired a lot of great things because it's so well done. One thing that it does transition to that I think is maybe a little unnecessary is because of this encounter in the subway, he becomes hyper aware that the heat is on and he's being followed. And so he decides to move this meetup about the handoff of these drugs to DC. And I just kind of don't need the second location. I mean, it feels like it messes with the pacing. I shouldn't say it slows it, but I feel like it messes with the pacing and it doesn't actually protect him from being followed. You see immediately that people are still have eyes on him, still following him. So it felt a little unnecessary, but it brings in that kind of like spy factor. I feel like we need a second location, you know? Yeah.
I will say for a first watch through, I don't know if other people feel the same way. And maybe it was because I was trying to take notes while I was watching. I didn't follow some of the story beats in this. Like I was a little lost at times of which person was in which group and which people were the French team and who was working with who. And I was like, okay, now they're doing this and whose car is this? And they stake out the empty car there. I had a lot of trouble following it for my first time through. I might have to give it a rewatch at some point now that I know, and I don't need to be taking notes throughout.
Yeah, there's a few little factors that are hard to follow. The Devereaux piece is a little hard to follow.
Yeah, because he's only in like three scenes. He barely appears, and for such a pivotal thing, it's strange.
And you kind of don't know, like, again, you don't know how much he knows or how much of it is intentional until much later. So it feels like it kind of messes with, well, it just makes the story hard to follow. I agree with you. And then the second car thing where they go to get this car at auction, and that's a little confusing because you're like, is it Devereaux's imported car that we're trying to auction or is it a new car? Right. So it is something I do think that takes a couple watches to fully understand the story, or you have to like read a beat by beat plot summary where you know exactly what's going on. But once you get the full picture, you're like, okay, I get the like cop beats of it. I get the spy beats of it almost a little bit. And again, I think that's pulling in that like international kind of vibes to it. And yeah, it
throws you in
sense.
The deep end the first time through. And I think it'll probably get better for me on a rewatch. The other thing that was a little throwing to me that I started like kind of giggling myself throughout, because I think there's 5 or 6 different shots of people from a distance. Like they're looking at somebody in the distance and it's inaudible dialogue. And it's just folks like talking to each other behind a glass window or like far away in the park. And it happens so many times through the movie. I just wrote down like people who can read lips must have fucking loved this film because they know everything that's happening, but there's so many of those shots.
And also, fun fact, this is very random, but you just made me think of it as well. If you watch this on certain platforms, you do not get the French subtitles. So you don't know some of what the French speaking stuff that is actually important to the story is being said.
I had to turn on Prime. I had to turn on the English subtitles because I think the very first scene or the second scene in this, or second major scene, is the two guys talking in French, and I didn't see anything. And I went, am I supposed to know what they're saying? Because it seems like
on
a very
Prime, they
comment.
Don't have the whole subtitles. You have to watch it on Apple TV Plus or Apple TV. Okay. Like you don't have to have Plus. You can rent it on Apple TV. And that's the only platform that I have found that has all the French subtitles.
Okay, so maybe it's just that first scene, because after that, I turned on the English subtitles and then I started getting the French. But that first scene might just not have subtitles.
Which has a lot of background. So that's actually why, like, PSA for y'all, like it helps you understand the story better. And having seen it before, I knew that. Like I started watching it on Prime as well. And I was like, where's the... So I went and found it, and that's the only reason I knew. But if you haven't seen it, you're not sure if you're supposed to understand some of those scenes or not. And spoiler alert, you are. You're supposed to understand the French there. You don't know what's going on. So, but yeah, that is part of it, of like, you've got to read some of that to understand the background as well.
We don't have to deviate into this for more than 30 seconds, but in that first or second scene when he's telling the lady, like, I figured out what, and he gives her the camera, like, what gift I'm going to get you for this trip. Is that his wife or his daughter?
That's his wife, I think. I think that's supposed to be his wife.
Okay. So we have another trend of very old men with very young women, because I thought it was his kid until I think there's a kiss or something. I went, oh, that doesn't seem like a daughter kiss.
No, that's supposed to be his wife. And it's I think I remember looking that up the first time and like double checking. But yeah, it's his second wife, I think, is the story. But yes, it is supposed to be his wife. But yes, very young. It is hard to tell at first, for sure.
Mormons in France. That's really going to know. Cool. Good for him.
And it gives you this whole energy of like his two personas, though, too, of his like cutthroat, you know, mobster, narcotics guy, and then this like sweet husband, you know. And I think that's also intentional, of he just has these two totally different lives. Yeah. Couple fun production notes that I just wanted to call out that I thought was cool. I always love when all the cars in a movie are clean, which makes me laugh. And
there's
then
no like McDonald's filet of fish garbage on the floorboards.
Right, just like they look fresh, like they look like they were freshly washed. You know what I mean? I'm like, that's not realistic. But anyways, and then I also like how they haven't really in this one figured out like the movie blood at this point. It's so like ketchupy and corn syrupy at this point. It's like so it's distracting in a few moments almost.
Agree with that.
So I thought that was fun. But I would like to spend a bunch of time talking about the chase. Like it's the inspiration for our cocktails here. Also, this is one of the best. This is considered one of the best chase scenes in movies, including to date. And it followed and kind of played homage to Bullet, which prior to this had the most famous chase scene and is part of why they wanted to emulate that. But they wanted to change it enough that it felt unique and it felt different, which they did a good job of doing. Rather than it just be two cars in pursuit, it is this car chasing a train, basically. Like, yes, he's chasing a guy, but the way he's chasing the guy is by chasing the train.
It's unique. I'm sure it's been done after this. I can't recall off the top of my head another movie that does this, but it's so one of a kind in my mind of typically a police chase car chasing car. This is so different from that. And he's trying to follow the tracks through a busy city. It's super intense. And this start to remind me if I'm wrong. This all starts with the sniper scene, right? That's the guy he's chasing. Mm-hmm, the guy tries mm-hmm. to shoot him. He mm-hmm. goes upstairs. That dude has such a fucking head start. First of all, Gene Hackman's Wild. On the roof, and that dude's already downstairs, and he still catches up to him on foot. And that leads into the train, the car, and everything that plays out after that. It's great.
It is great. And I think like we have to talk about how raw it is in a number of ways. Like this is a very raw, visceral chase scene. And again, I think that's why it is differentiated from Bullet in one way, but it also maintains a similar vibe of just intensity and speed and all the things. But it is shot. So all kinds of notes for you guys here. It is shot with no permits, right? There are no roadblocks in this chase scene. There are several people who are off-duty cops. There are actors and stuntmen and extras who know what's going on, and the woman with the baby knows what's going on. But the woman with the baby scene is the only choreographed scene, and that was, for obvious reasons, very carefully planned. So he's coming at her and she moves out the way. That's the only choreographed scene. The rest of this chase is Bill Hickman, has to be called out, stuntman here, driving at over 90 miles an hour for 25 blocks. In yeah. unblocked, real traffic. Like, fucking bananas, y'all. Like,
it's insane how they didn't get sued. Or he, I mean, credit to him as a driver yeah. for, you know, not hitting anyone that didn't know that there was a movie being filmed at that time. And I just love the three, they sort of film it in three different ways. They have the outer shots of the car, like going through traffic from a distance. They have the one camera that's interior facing Gene Hackman for the close-ups. You see his reactions. And mm-hmm. then they have that bumper cam at the front of the car, which is just so cool. And again, it's 1971. So I don't know yeah. if this was the first, but it's incredible to watch from those different angles.
I do think it's the first bumper cam, if I recall correctly. But the other thing too is that he films it himself, freaking films it himself. And part of that is because the other cameramen were young and had wives and children, and they were very concerned about an actual wreck happening here. So he shot it himself. The other folks were, I don't know if they were straight up unwilling, but they were concerned about it. Yeah. So he films over Gene Hackman's shoulder. So that angle mm. that you see the whole time, that's him filming it himself. And it is amazing that they didn't get arrested. More amazing is that they bribed an official to do this. So no official permits. They couldn't afford permitting. They couldn't afford roadblocks. But they bribed an official guy with the MTA, $40,000 and a one-way ticket to Jamaica to get them on the train. He's the guy that gets fake shot on the train operator, and film that scene. And he literally left the country after this. And his comment to them was like, well, I'm going to lose my job after y'all do this. So like, I need a one-way ticket out of here. His whereabouts are supposedly still unknown.
I feel like it would even potentially be worse than losing your job. I feel like if you're like, I'm going to commandeer this train so I can be in a
arrested.
Movie.
Arrested. Yeah. Yeah.
I had a couple questions throughout this sequence. Number one, I was going to do this as a cold open, but obviously we wanted to remember Gene and talk about him. But Mackenzie, putting you on the spot, you're driving, someone jumps in front of you with a badge and says, I need to commandeer your car. What do you do?
I scoot over. I'm going with.
Oh, you're riding shotgun.
I'm riding shotgun.
Could have been a fun little, like, then we get a spinoff movie with Gene Hackman.
You're not taking, number one, you're not taking my car, and I don't know yeah. what's happening with it. If you know me, if you have met me, I have a thing about my cars. They are my babies. You may not take my vehicle. If you need it for an emergency, that's fine. I'm just going to scooch over, and I'm coming with.
Okay. Like, that's one way I did not think. I just was like, I'm just going to keep driving. After seeing what happens to this poor guy's car in this film after giving it to the cops, I hope he got reimbursed, you know? And then
that crash was unscripted. That was a real crash.
Really? Yeah. Holy shit. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was, again, that's Bill Hickman, the stunt guy driving for Gene Hackman. It is important to note, he did actually want to call out, Gene Hackman did drive for half of the cuts that ended up in the final cut. So he did drive, but a lot of the really bad accidents or the really hard sections were Bill Hickman. And I do think Bill Hickman's the one who got hit. But that was an unscripted crash.
It's just, I want to ask my other question, but I just love, again, how long this plays out over the course of and how the car is just getting beaten up. He's hitting different things. He's pausing to like check out the train, the stops. The guy doesn't get off. Mm-hmm. He gets back in the car. The train doesn't stop at the one stop it's supposed to. He gets back in the car. It's just, it plays out. I don't remember how long it was. It felt like I was watching this chase for 10-ish minutes, 15 minutes, and it's
I think
great.
It is. I used to know the runtime. It's something like 11 minutes. Like, it's a good chunk. It's really long. It's really long. So, but it's great. Like, you watch the whole thing, and it's engaging the whole time.
Yeah. The final act of this is brilliant and just keeps you. For as slow as that first act is, once you get to the payoff, it's incredible. My other question is, I'm watching this train barrel through. The guy gets shot. It's careening out of control. It's going to hit. Where the fuck is Spider-Man in all of this? I know
that fucking guy.
He was in New York around this time, and he doesn't even pop in to try and do anything.
I think he was in class.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, it's some bullshit. Don't get me wrong. But, like, he had to be in class, right? Like, it's the middle of the day. You know?
It must be. I felt a little hurt that he didn't show up. And I'm sure there's a comic book nerd out there that's going to be like, Spider-Man wasn't written. I feel like he was probably written by 71, but let me know if I'm off base, comic nerds.
I actually did used to read those, but I was a 90s baby at that time. So I don't remember when they were published, but
I will give Spider-Man an apology if it turns out that he was not written into New York by 1971.
Maybe not. But also, you know, he was kind of a nerd, you know, so he was probably in class just being a studious student. But, you know, we need you to come save lives, sir. It's important. But okay. So, couple fun fun things about this chase and how it kind of culminates. So, like we said, he stops a bunch of times. He finally gets, you know, runs up to this guy. The train operator gets shot. It's like, it's a whole thing. But then he comes down. He comes running down the stairs, and Gene Hackman just fucking shoots him in the back. Like, we have to talk about that. Like, and I think that the actual Popeye was like a little offended by that. He was like, we would never have done that. We would never have just shot somebody in the back. And my first note when I see this guy, I haven't watched this in a while, I was like, that's probably not a kill shot, but like, okay. And we went through all that to try and catch this guy and question him. And then we just kill him immediately.
It's a questionable decision. I feel like nowadays the tropey thing to do is have that guy who's, you know, being held at gunpoint try to pull a gun of his own and then he gets shot. That's what we would do nowadays. I did find that strange, but also I'm like, dude, he's been chasing him for 11 fucking minutes. He's like, you're not getting on any other vehicle. This chase ends here.
He's probably he's just beat. He's like, I can't do it anymore. I'm done.
I'm so out of breath.
I'm so fucking tired. I am 41, sir. Like, I'm not doing this anymore.
He shoots him and then just walks off and gets a Gatorade. And he's just like, fuck this. But ballsy move by the stuntman in that. I wrote that down. He falls backwards down a set of New York steps onto what looks like concrete. I don't know how they faked it, but he almost does a headstand vertically on the stairs
over and over.
Topples.
Yes.
Yeah.
And how do you not break your fucking neck? You know, like, it's just, I mean, again, I'm so glad we did the Fall Guy so we could call so much attention to stunts, but it has really also opened my eyes personally to every time I see a crazy stunt, I'm like, this, I mean, you always notice when there's a crazy stunt, but I just even more appreciation for what they go through to get these shots. It's fucking nuts for sure. Yeah. And also, fun fact for you, Spider-Man was 1962 was his first appearance.
Well, then I stand by it. Bring me Spider-Man.
You know? Bring me Spider-Man. Exactly. But I love, so we got to, the other thing with the car and the chase and all that is that they find drugs in the car. And to your point, I want to spend a minute on that. That whole scene of breaking down this car is so stressful. And you almost kind of lose faith in Popeye for a hot second. You're kind of like, is he reaching? You know, because this thing at various points has felt kind of like a reach, and he just killed this random dude, and you know, he's a little cray cray, so like, is he reaching for this? And they have totally broken down this car seemingly to the bolts, right? And they can't figure out where the fucking drugs are, and they find them, again, homage to our cocktail today, in the sidecar, in the rocker boards on the sides of
the car.
And it's
thanks to Buddy too. It's not Pop. It's him having his partner's back and just being like, I know my partner well enough that his intuition's usually so good. And then he's looking at the weight of the vehicle and he's the one that figures it out of. That's the one place we haven't checked.
Which is such a great call out too, of like, just again, minute details. What are we missing? What is the thing? He's like, no, this is right. And we haven't talked enough about Buddy. He really does back Popeye's plays throughout and, you know, tries to be the balance to him. And he knows that while he maybe presents as a hothead, he's still a good, smart detective, and he sort of brings a sense of calm and a plus one, so to speak, to whatever Popeye is saying. Even earlier when they're trying to get the wiretap, you know, he's like, "Do you believe in this?" And he's like, "I believe in my partner." You know, like he's loyal as fuck. We love Buddy.
I think that's probably the one he gets overshadowed a little bit for sure.
He does,
and that's probably why we haven't talked about him enough. But I do think the loyalty and the trust in his partners is one real factor, because otherwise parts of him do feel like he's just this. He's Popeye Light in some cases, where it's like you can't both be bad cop and like push and beating the shit out of this drug dealer. But yeah, I think that what you just talked about was exactly what makes him different.
Yeah, he's different, and I think he's really admirable. You see his loyalty throughout. But speaking of loyalty, what about disloyalty? Oh my God, so we get to the end, right? Like we get to like we're coming to a head with these. The drug deal has occurred. Dipshit from France wants to get away, run away. They come and they stop him, right? They're like they're racing to him. They've let them take the car. They want to catch them in the act with the drugs so that they can arrest them, all the things. And this motherfucker turns around and runs back to the warehouse. He's just like, you know what? I'm going to get my odds increase of getting away if I bring the cops to everyone else and I keep running. And I was like, this motherfucker is so disloyal and so every man for himself.
I mean, I wrote down, Mackenzie, we've already played a game of tag in this movie with the chase. Now we have to play hide and seek. So it makes total logical sense in my mind, you know?
It is a natural next step. It is a natural next step. But there's a lot happens really fast here. I think, like you said, once we get off and running, like it kind of doesn't stop. And this continues here as well. They come to this warehouse, there's a massive shootout. And then, you know, Popeye is just relentless. He wants to find this guy. And in the process, of course, as you alluded to earlier, shoots his favorite guy, Moldering, by accident. Thinks he's getting.
It's so the trigger happy component there. Yes. That's the one time in the movie where you're like, oh, he's not a very good cop.
No, I don't even know if he's not a good cop or if he's just like the ends justify. I mean, in that sense, it does make him not a good cop, but I think he's a good detective. Like he can observe things and go with his gut and things like that. But you're right. I think he doesn't know how to moderate himself. Right. And I think that's a big part of why Buddy is necessary in a lot of situations. But at this point, you know, it's heightened. We're mid chase. Like you're not bringing this guy down, and he's just shooting in hopes that he's gonna, you know, get Fernando Rey or Alan's character or what have you. And he's just gonna kill him. And he misses by a mile and gets Moldering, who again is his stuntman. So that's just rude. But it's also, he gets up there, he realizes it's Moldering, and he gives zero fucks.
Like, yeah, he's just like, okay, well, let's go find the other guy so I can shoot him too.
He's like, listen, I have shit to do. I don't have time to sit here and deal with this. Yeah, and he just keeps running.
We'll like tie in, like I want to talk in a second about the end credits and sort of the title cards we get there of what happened to these people. But I didn't love how that was downplayed, like you just said. And it feels almost like an unnecessary, leaves you with a bad feeling at the end of the film for how much work they've put into it. It's like, oh, it's kind of all ends up being for nothing. And then he also probably is going to get fired because he got another cop killed, an FBI agent in the line of duty. But I did write down on a lighter note that I like how throughout this, it's Popeye sort of chasing after Elaine and Buddy is the one pursuing Sal. It feels like almost like they're pairing off to chase these two different guys. And when Buddy finally shoots and kills Sal, I was like, no smile, you son of a bitch. That feels like a layup at this point, you know? I feel like I needed that to be there is all I'm saying. I know this was before that, but I don't give a shit.
But you just need a little something, yes. Something.
Scheider should just work that into every role, past, present,
right.
Future.
That's his vibe. That's his mark. I love it. Yeah, I mean, this is a hard ending, I think, to for most audiences. And I think it's very telling how great the rest of the movie is, that it's so well received still, and it won so many awards and people rate it so highly, because if you do think about it, it does feel at the end like this was all for naught, so to speak, because Elaine does get away, and that is true of the real character as well. Like he doesn't get caught, and it ends in a way where I almost wish you didn't have the post credits for that reason, because you just hear a shot, right? He runs up.
I was like,
him.
Why are we having this gunshot if we're going to say afterward, like, well, what was that for then? So I'm sorry, continue.
No, you're right. But you just get this, you get this tease of like, okay, maybe they got him. Like, boom, it was all worth it, right? You literally just get the boom and you're like, oh, he got him, you know? And also, what was he shooting at? Because it's one single shot.
He probably just shot another cop, honestly. He probably killed somebody else. He's going around this building, just popping off. Yeah, there's so many dead cops by the end
of
this.
Fuck it, I'm going to shoot any. If you're in my eye line, you're getting shot. Fuck off.
They should have added that to his little character card at the end. Popeye killed 8 more police officers that day until he ran out of bullets. Yeah.
He was not fired from the force, just so you know. Like, oh my God. It's so true. I don't know what he shoots at, but he shoots at something and you get this moment of, oh, he got him, and then you immediately are like,
told, no,
not got him. She's not got him.
And they, like, apparently, you know, for this winning Best Picture, a lot of, I guess you would call them more casual people, like myself, honestly, were not happy with the, that was like the one part they didn't like, was the ending of that gunshot. Yeah. And then the title cards that just bring you down, and how many questions are still left unanswered, to the point that they did end up making a sequel to this that was almost just to appease the fans who didn't like that ending. I'm sure it was kind of a cash grab too, but it's Popeye pursuing Elaine again because people wanted a more traditional. I haven't watched it, but I assume it kind of wraps up a little happier than how this one does.
Yeah, I actually never saw the second one. I am kind of a purist sometimes with some of those, and right. I never watched it, but I agree with you. I think it's really hard. It also implies, and the real life characters were a little offended because it implies that they, this partner pair are held responsible for how badly this goes. And it says they're transferred out of the narcotics unit and reassigned and broken up like as partners. And that did happen, but it happened 8 years later for unrelated reasons.
Yeah, it makes no sense that they would be kicked out, because this main guy got away, but they did infiltrate this entire thing and caught a bunch of people and stopped a bunch of drugs from coming into the city. So it doesn't seem like, I mean, the FBI thing would probably be what ended up being like, you guys got to go. But the rest of the investigation, I thought, was pretty successful.
But also, like, nobody holds cops accountable, let's be honest. So to imply that they did is kind of laughable. So they just, you know, they just get to get implied that they got fired basically for this. And they still, while the charges didn't hold up, like, they ultimately, to your point, yes, did do good police work. They impacted this drug deal. Things that were genuinely stopped here that they were supposed to stop, and they did. And so it is kind of a weird implication there. So they didn't appreciate that. But my favorite thing is that Devereaux, the fucking wingman, who doesn't know what the fuck is going on.
He doesn't know shit about fuck.
Yeah. He doesn't know shit about fuck. Gets 4 years in a federal penitentiary for conspiracy. This poor man. Like, I just felt for him. I was like, he must, hopefully it's a nice cell. I don't know.
I was going to say, I hope he's a method actor and he got out and just went Daniel Day-Lewis and was like, I'm going to only take prisoner roles because I'm an expert at this shit now.
Honestly, I just was like, wow, this poor, poor man. Because he was held the most accountable. It's kind of wild. Oh, but anyway, great film. I think it's a good time, despite the you know, kind of the tie up at the end being a little bit of a bummer. I think it's a really fun watch, and it, and like you said, it establishes so many themes that we see in so many great cop and spy and action flicks later. So I think it's an important watch for people. But what would be your rating?
As I said, for a first watch, there were times where I was a little overwhelmed and having trouble tracking, which I was the same way in The Wire season one. So again, to bring that up, and then I've rewatched that.
Who wasn't? It was a lot.
Yeah, they throw you right into the deep end on that too. So I think with a rewatch, my rating would probably go up. But for now, I'm going to recognize how original this was, how unique some of the components are, how it influenced so many other films that folks love. And there were obviously things that I mentioned that I didn't like, but I'm still going to give this like an 8 on a first watch. I think it's really fucking good.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd go solid 8 here. And like I said, I've seen it a couple of times, but, and that helps for sure. But I do think it's not perfect. There are some loose ends and there are some things that are like a little cheesy in the way that they're delivered. But like, I just can't get over some of the key moments that are so clever and so strong, and the beats and like the chasing is so
I would go back
cool.
and rewatch the sniper scene through the end of the film today. That's how entertaining that act of the film was.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so good. It's so, so good. So yeah, I'd give it a solid 8 for sure. I think
Well done. Just to wrap us up here, I got 2 more fun facts for you. Number one is you can actually visit the train car that is in the Brooklyn Transit Museum, which is kind of cool. So you can go see the train car that was used in this. And number two is my best friend used to live in Poughkeepsie. So I have picked my feet in Poughkeepsie. Just throwing that out there.
Which, if you didn't know when you watched this, is a euphemism for like dealing drugs and doing drugs. Okay.
I thought I read something different where it was basically the cops this was based on said they would throw nonsense words out at perps, basically, for lack of a better term, just to fuck with them. So they're sort of accusing them of like, you got drugs on, you got this, blah, blah. And then they throw out something that makes no fucking sense like that to just get them riled up and to be like, yeah, you know what? Stop saying that to me. I do have drugs on me. Here you go, sir. So I read that. I don't know which one is true. They could both be true, but who knows?
Yeah, I totally read different. So that's interesting. Somebody tell us. Call us and tell us which one's accurate. I'm not going to Google it. We've done enough research for you guys. I'm done. Anyways, well, thanks for hanging with us. This was a great time. Again, rest in power, Gene Hackman, incredible performance. Go watch all of his things. They're incredible. But come back next week for our next entry in Action April, which will be Escape from New York.
80s, baby.
80s, baby. Also, funnily enough, when we record, Lamar, I will be getting back from New York. So
you had just escaped from New York.
Escaped from New York. It's going to be on theme. Anyways, in the meantime,
you know what to do. Follow us on our socials, Instagram, TikTok. You can watch video of each week on YouTube. You can also watch video on Spotify, and you can always reach us by email at wedrinkandwewatchthingspod@gmail.com. So if you want to be mad at Spider-Man with me, go ahead and send that over there. And any other questions, recommendations, fuck ups that we had, anything like that.
Be kind, because I'm the only one who reads that. Okay?
Thank you. Yeah, that's true. I said, like, go complain at the email that I never look at. Yeah.
To McKinsey. Go complain to McKinsey. Anyways, well, thank y'all again for hanging. For now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers.